I'm excited, Johnny. I've really been enjoying our deep dive into storytelling, and today's guest has given one of my favorite TEDx talks of all time.
Yes, David is great. And what I really enjoy, and the audience is going to enjoy today, is just how well he can compartmentalize the process of storytelling.
And of course, take the science behind telling compelling stories and put it together in a framework that we all use. This is the Art of Charm podcast, the show where we bring you actual tips and strategies on how to better connect socially, boost your emotional intelligence, and of course, tell engaging stories to crush it in business, love, and life. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors teaching you their expertise, packing decades of research, testing, and of course, tough lessons into a concise curriculum each and every week. I'm AJ.
And I'm Johnny.
Now, not only have we been doing this podcast with great tips and scientifically proven social strategies with amazing guests, we've also been delivering live and online advanced emotional intelligence training programs for over a decade. I can't believe it's been 13 years. If what you've learned on this show has helped you in your life, imagine what one of our tailored programs could do for you. To learn more about these advanced social skills programs, go to theartofcharm.com/bootcamp for more details and to sign up for our newsletter.
Also, we are now doing corporate training. So if you are interested in our team, including myself and AJ, coming to your office to work on team building, conflict resolution, and networking, send us an email at aj@theartofcharm.com. And remember, a happy office is a productive office.
Take your life and career to the next level now with our coaching. And just before we start, we'd also love to take the opportunity to reach out to our audience members who work in the psychology fields, either as a psychologist or a therapist. We have some really awesome projects we're working on, and we'd love your input. You can drop me a line at aj@theartofcharm.com. Thank you for tuning in. Let's kick off the show. Today, we're talking with David J.P. Phillips. Now, David delivers worldwide training on communication and presentation skills. And what we particularly love about his work is that it's focused on the latest research in neurology, psychology, and even biology. A few years ago, David did a study on 5,000 public speakers to analyze what makes a storyteller exceptional. And we'll talk about a few of his many findings. His three TEDx talks are among the most viewed TEDx talks on storytelling and certainly some of my favorites. Hello and welcome to the show, David. How did you get started in storytelling, especially the research behind it?
Well, my passion has been communication my entire life. For me, that is the single most important subject any human can learn. And about 5 years ago, I just started being really mesmerized by the effects of storytelling. I got to think, how can it be so powerful? It's almost like it's mind-blowingly powerful. And whenever I find anything that is remotely mind-blowingly powerful, I just have to dig into it.
Absolutely. And I know for us this month, we've been talking a lot about the importance of emotions in storytelling, how to become a better storyteller. And a lot of our listeners and our clients ask us exactly that. How can we strengthen our storytelling skills so that we can have a compelling interaction that becomes memorable? Because we've all been influenced by that one story that we held on to and we loved. A lot of us don't feel that strong in this department.
That's true.
And how do we get practice in developing out our storytelling skills?
Well, I would say that my recommendation is, as with anything in communication, that is, when I do training in communication, I do training in storytelling, people think that when they're on stage, that's when they're supposed to practice. But that is entirely incorrect. So where you're supposed to practice is your everyday life. Your every single conversation, every meeting, by the coffee machine, by the car, wherever you are, that's when you're supposed to practice it. And then what happens is, if you could become brilliant there, you are simply brilliant on stage. Now, my practical tip for what you should practice is the following. That whenever you're in a situation and it's at least remotely funny or remotely weird or remotely strange or anything that sticks out, you should look at that situation from the four basic steps of storytelling. And the four basic steps of storytelling, as I teach, is a prep, background, development, and conclusion. So whatever strange situation you're in, you just form it in those four boxes in your head as you're standing there. And then you see, can I make that funny? Can I make that interesting? Can I make that even more weird or whatever? And then you try it on someone and they go like, ooh, maybe they laugh. And then you go, yeah, that's cool. And then you just tweak it a bit and tweak it a bit and tweak it a bit and tweak it a bit. And boom, you have a good story. That is the best way to learn storytelling. You do that every single day. My God, you'll be a storyteller in no time.
I think, you know, lots of great things happen to us on a daily basis. And in those moments, we have that chuckle to ourselves. I mean, those are opportunities to make a mental note. And what's great about this is I started doing this a few years ago. It's like we have these devices in our pockets now, and I have a running pages of just interesting things and my perspective on it and why it stuck out to me that day. So that, you know, when I do go back, when I'm looking for stories, when I'm looking for anecdotes to showcase something, I have these things where I'm the main character, but it's happened to me. And that perspective allows for others to put themselves in my position and experience those things.
Absolutely. That's a brilliant thing. Just copy paste that. That's superb.
Well, the other point that you make that's so important is reading the audience and actually practicing on people to see their response. Because sometimes we can think a story is great when we only share it with ourselves and we're telling it in our head, but we don't know how that story is going to sound until we actually start sharing it with people.
True. Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's the thing. That's the way you learn storytelling. And I like that idea by just writing down the different situations you're in and the scenarios that happen to you in your everyday life, and you just package it. But I think the thing is to package it in real time, where you are there with these four steps, because that is what really brings storytelling to life.
So let's break down those four steps, the prep, the background, and obviously understanding storytelling to a great degree. It's important that we allow the audience to know where this is transpiring, where this story is beginning, and a little bit of that backstory. So what is the prep?
Yeah. Okay, so I'll just give you a real-time story then. You just called me, let's see here, 22 minutes ago. I was at home. I was sitting with my kids. I was looking through a photo album, and I thought that we were going to go live at 6:30. Okay, so that's a story for you. So I'll tell it the incorrect way first, which goes like this. I was at home, I was looking at the photos, and then I saw that, and then I panicked, I ran to the office, I came here, and then I got everything together, and now I'm here with you guys. So that's a bad way of telling a story. Better way of telling a story is, okay, so imagine I'm at home, I'm sitting there with my kids, I'm looking through the photos, and I'm all like, my empathy, and I'm feeling things for these photos, and then suddenly, the last thing you want in the world, the last thing, you get a phone call from the US. You go like, oh, shit. Something's wrong. Something's up. I've missed something. You know that feeling of panic. So I tremble on my voice. I pick up the phone and there's someone on the other side and they go like, hey, where are you? And I'm like, oh, crap. I've got to run. And I just run out of the house. I run over the yard. I come in. I rig everything up. And the terrible part about all of this is that when I sit down, I've got all this stuff up and I think, okay, we're going to go live now. You guys, you want me to turn on my video camera and hey, do you see what I look like? This is not my professional me, but sometimes you just have to play the game, right? So I'm sitting here now and it's brilliant. Thanks for having me. It is such a pleasure seeing you. Thanks. Okay, so that's a better way of telling the story. The prep is I'm sitting at home with my kids. The development is I'm running over the background is I'm running over the yard. The development is what happens here, and the conclusion is that I'm happy to be with you guys.
Over the last 17 years, we have launched our fair share of online courses, coaching programs, and finding the right platform has always been a challenge.
They say if you do what you love, you never work a day in your life. But if you're an entrepreneur, you know the hard work that comes with it. That's why you need Kajabi. Kajabi makes it easy to run your entire online business from one platform so you can focus on what you love, creating.
Kajabi is the ultimate all-in-one platform that helps creators and entrepreneurs build successful online businesses by unlocking predictable recurring revenue.
No matter your niche,
Kajabi makes it easy to turn your skills, passions, and experiences into enriching online courses, exclusive membership sites, subscription podcasts, thriving communities, personalized coaching, and more.
The best part? Kajabi doesn't cut into your revenue because everything is owned and controlled by you. So keep 100% of what you earn.
And with Kajabi, you also get robust analytics, easy payment options, email marketing tools, and customizable website templates, all built in.
You don't even need a huge audience to make sustainable income. There are thousands of creators on Kajabi making six and seven figures with less than 50,000 followers.
Right now, Kajabi is offering a free 30-day trial to start your business if you go to kajabi.com/charm. That's kajabi.com/charm.
Go to kajabi.com/charm and join the creators and entrepreneurs who have made over $7 billion.
Hey, Art of Charm listeners, I'm excited to share a new podcast I've been absolutely binging. Winning is an everyday mindset, and Craig Robinson and John Calipari are here to help. On Ways to Win podcast, Craig and Coach Cal use their on-court wisdom to solve your off-court problems. Whether it's trouble at home or a workplace dilemma, the coaches will help you find a winning formula for success. You'll hear from prominent athletes, business leaders, and celebrities who reveal insights that made them into the leaders they are today. And don't miss President Obama sharing how he deals with pressure by projecting confidence, believing in your team, and taking criticism. Listen to Ways to Win wherever you get your podcasts.
What's great about this is giving it the first example, and you gave us all the data points, and we can all understand that, but there's certainly no emotions involved. But what did you add for the emotions to kick in? Well, I immediately felt the emotions kick in when you mentioned I was sitting there with my children. Mm-hmm. We were looking at some old photos. So now we understand how precious the time is with spending with our children. Looking at old photos where you're probably telling some stories to your children and eliciting some emotions from them and creating this environment, we can all understand what a surreal and beautiful moment that is, only to be all of a sudden alerted that you were missing an appointment and you were in the wrong place, to now have to drop everything that is going on and running to the office and of course, prepping yourself for the interview that's going to be at hand. I mean, there are so many emotional bids there that I felt shift and engage from both stories and just that small sample.
Let's talk about this angel's cocktail that you just discussed, right? Because these four signals that you cover in your angel's cocktail are so important in creating this dynamic in the story to allow the audience to be fully engaged. Can you unpack those again for the audience?
We have four basic signaling substances, so let's say five signaling substances and hormones, which control our emotions. They are our emotions. Our emotions are signaling substances and hormones, chemicals in our brain. What's interesting is depending on which one has a high concentration, it will influence your psychology. So if you have a high concentration of oxytocin, you will tend to be more generous, feel more empathy, and you'll feel more bonding with the person. And the second one is serotonin. Now, serotonin is produced when we feel pride, when we feel significant. So any story which increases serotonin will make the other person feel more significant, increase their self-worth, and they'll feel more pride. The third one is dopamine, which is expectation, and it's easily the most important one. So I won't take that one now. I'll go to number four instead. We'll cover endorphins. Endorphins is something that just makes you less critical and it'll make you a happier person and you'll be more willing to listen to whatever is being said, more accepting. Now, the last one is testosterone, and testosterone will make you more risk-taking. So if I, in a story, induce testosterone in you, you will become more risk-taking as a human being. Okay, I think that was that. Or maybe we should go back to dopamine and just describe that just a little bit more.
Yeah.
Can't leave that hanging there. Okay, so dopamine is created when you get cliffhangers. Dopamine is behind all motivation. So I'll put it like this. Every single time you sit in an audience and you lose focus from whoever is speaking or presenting, and if you're turning this pod off, it means that you are getting dopamine from somewhere else because you are addicted to it. So dopamine creates focus, creativity, memory. Focus creativity, memory, and motivation. Would you say that those are important things in any story or any presentation?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because just imagine that the next time you deliver a presentation, nobody's focused, motivated, nor creative, nor do they remember anything that you just said. Yeah, so that's the reason why we turn off TV series. That's the reason why we turn off movies. It's because we simply were not stimulated enough by the desire to know what's happening next.
We can all understand the importance of these and with dopamine being able to create them. And I think a lot of us look for opportunities to get more motivation or to get more focus and get better memory throughout the day. With the technology that is in front of us, do you see any issues with our dopamine receptors being either overly stimulated and it's going to take more and more now, or is it simply desensitized to a lot of different stimulus?
Yeah, well, easily our dopamine receptors are overstimulated. We're desensitized, absolutely, to a certain extent. I think the problem today is that our attention span is so much shorter than it was before. In the past, in the good old days. Yes, it was way, way, way longer. So the problem today is that we can get dopamine injections, like immediately, by just bringing up our phone, checking social media, checking Candy Crush or TikTok or whatever. You can just imagine, you every single time you do that, you bring out a needle and you go in your veins. Every single time you do that. And I call dopamine the fabricated happiness. So dopamine is fabricated happiness. And the less happy you are with your life, the more you want dopamine, because it gives you that quick hit. But the problem is that you go, life is beautiful. And then you go, and you go, and that is your life. It goes up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. So yeah, the problem with that is that it is so hard to hold someone's attention when presenting, speaking, or even during a pod show. And the attention span is getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, because all these Facebook, YouTube. Did you know that YouTube, 72% of everything that you watch is recommended by the artificial intelligence engine? Yep. It's insane. And it's optimized for you to look at things that grabs your attention as fast and as much as possible. But you know what? I usually say this. The people living today who will die within the next 20 to 30 years, that is our last generation of storytellers. It is the last generation of storytellers. Those who lived before the television came by, those who listened to their grandfathers and grandmothers when they told stories. This is an art which is dying, but what's sad with that is that I can have kids in front of me, totally addicted to TikTok, totally addicted to YouTube, but they will drop their phones and listen to a story, because it kicks ass with anything out there.
So looking at those molecules and obviously their importance in generating emotions, how can we as storytellers elicit those emotional responses and those chemicals in the audience?
You can, well, let's start with the most important one, which is dopamine. You should add hooks to your story, which means that in your story, you should say that something is coming up, but not exactly what. Simple example could be that a very short story is of a man who got out of bed, but as he was getting out, things seemed to be just a little bit too quiet around him. It didn't bother much, but he walked towards the door. The door was open and he knew that he'd closed it when he'd gone to bed and nobody was at home then. But still, it was too quiet. So he walks out. He walks up to the balcony, looks down. And there he sees exactly what he knew that he'd never wanted to see in his entire life. But it was there, straight in front of him. And there you go. That's dopamine for you.
Yeah, what's there? We're hanging on. Cliffhanger. Okay, so cliffhangers elicit that focus, motivation, better memory. What can we do with oxytocin to elicit that?
Oxytocin is bonding with a character or an object. So bonding with a character or an object. And that's the reason why you have so much junk in your cellars and in your attics. It's because you've bonded with the items there. You feel for them through oxytocin. And it feels like you get ripped apart when somebody would throw them away. So yeah, you would create a character which we would feel for. And you know what's almost terrible with oxytocin? It is that we fall for it and we crave it so badly, we can even bypass our morals and ethics. I'll give you an example from Breaking Bad. You know the show Breaking Bad?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so people all over the world, they've been watching Breaking Bad. What's sad with that is that people behind the TV screens, they're going like, Yeah, come on, brew more meth, man, go. Yeah, brew it. Yeah, brew big an industry, build an industry, become a magnet, become a drug king, shoot the police. Yes, just win over them. You can own this. Yes, and I know this is smuggled to kids and kids die from it, but still brew more. And we're on the other side and we're rooting for the bad guy like we're insane. And that is the power of oxytocin. If you as an author, you write... in this case, what was his name? The main character of Breaking
Walter
Bad.
White.
Yeah. And what did he have?
Well, he had cancer.
Cancer, yeah. So this story wouldn't have worked if he didn't have cancer. But because we feel empathy for him through the cancer, we can bypass other things, bad things that he do because, you know, it's at the end of his life and so on and so forth.
So that bonding, that connection is what elicits oxytocin. And endorphin, creativity, relaxation, focus. How can we elicit this in a story?
Well, I'm really sorry, guys, but I forgot. Yeah, I'm sorry. I can't remember. If we can just restart, I could remember it for you. Well, that's oxytocin for you. Okay, I just wanted to give you an example. Yeah, okay, sorry about that. Let's move over to endorphins. Okay, so you're laughing at the moment, which means that I induced endorphins in you, which is great. So that is the simple thing with endorphins. Just make people laugh, tell jokes.
Adding some humor.
Add humor to your stories, yeah.
And testosterone, risk-taking, that one seems a little more challenging.
Testosterone, yeah, that could be challenging, but no, you just tell hero stories, really. So I could tell you a hero story, and what's good with that hero story is that it induces both testosterone and serotonin. It goes like this. The man was 20 years old. He looked back at his life, and he concluded that this was not what he intended. This is not what he wanted. At 15 years of age, he'd been thrown out from home after... fighting with his brother. He'd made a woman pregnant. He had a child. The woman had left him. He'd put a company into bankruptcy. And he said to him, sad in a self-sad voice, this was not what I intended in my life. But he was a smart and clever guy. He wasn't religious specifically, but he loved the idea by having words and laws to live by. So what he did, he took a piece of paper and wrote down the 12 things that he wanted to become. And at the top, he wrote the date or the days of the month. So it was kind of two axes. One axis with things he wanted to be and one axis with the days of the month. He walked over to his friend and said, look at this, look at this. This is brilliant. What a method I've come up with. And the friend was far from happy. The friend said, I don't know. That's silly. Why is it silly? Well, because you're none of them. Well, that's the problem. That's why my life looks the way it looks. And the friend said, hey, if you're going to do this, you should add a 13th because, my God, you need it. Add humility. And this guy went, humility, tasted it. Yeah. Okay, cool. We'll go with humility. This guy was far from humble because what he wrote behind each of these, he wrote what they were meant. And behind humility, he wrote no less than Socrates or Jesus, which is far from humble, I think. And then he began life. He became an author. He became an inventor. And a true story, he invented the iron stove. He invented the bifocal glasses, the swim feet, and the lightning rod. But all that pales in comparison when we know now that he founded the first library and the first insurance company in the US. But all that pales in comparison because he also is seen to be one of the fathers, or the main father, behind the American Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. But that also pales in comparison that he was the trusted advisor of the three first presidents of the United States of America, George Washington, John Adams, and Thomas Jefferson. Now, when he died at 82, he'd written in his diary at 81, Benjamin Franklin wrote, because that was his name. You can find him on the $100 bills in the US today, and he's seen to be one of the most influential characters of the US history. He wrote in his diary when he was 81, I became what I wanted because one day I chose who I wanted to be. So, fellow listeners, when did you choose who you wanted to be? Because apparently it can have a tremendous effect. The end.
That's fantastic.
So how did we elicit testosterone and serotonin in that story?
Well, probably more serotonin, but you get a feel for that. You go like, wow, that's a pretty cool person. And you feel, you don't feel envy, but you feel that you want to go home and maybe you just want to do something systematically different in your life because you sense that you have a power over your life. So I would say that would be it. But then testosterone is always released when you win, and he won.
Right.
But if I wanted to induce pure testosterone, I would probably give you more of an even bigger success, and more masculinity, more nakedness, more hardcore, more risk.
So like a warrior story, a hero's journey.
Yeah, like a hero warrior.
And obviously, looking at these stories and their importance in communication, personally, we know they connect us and bind us together, but they're also used in business. So you look at presenting ideas, selling, pitching, trying to go to networking events. We talked about this in networking last month. And I feel like a lot of us sort of don't view them the same. And what is your view on that? Whether we're personally telling stories or we're sharing these stories professionally, do these rules still apply?
Absolutely. Yeah. No question about it. Nah. No question about it. Hey, a quick tip for you is this. Just as you did there with the example where you wrote down events that happened to you, what you can do is what I would recommend every single person on this pod to do, and you too. Write down the stories that you tell. You can just use the title. You don't have to word them word by word, just the titles. And you use Excel or something similar. You write down all your stories in one column, and then the power comes when you start indexing them. So the powers that people laugh at, index them as endorphins. People that the stories that people feel empathy for, index them as oxytocin. The stories that people feel success and pride in, index them as serotonin. Stories that people feel that they cannot stop listening to. You always got their absolute, absolute anticipation. I can tell you one of those later if you want to. But one of those super hardcore dopamine stories. Then you just, you classify that as dopamine. And if you tell a story where after you've told the story, people are like really hungry. You can see them, their eyes, that they want to do something. They want to win something. You classify that as testosterone. And you do that with every single one of your stories. And imagine that you have 100 stories. That means that you now have 100 more or less weapons in your pocket. Because if you walk into a crowd and you go like, these need oxytocin. And they might need a bit of endorphins. Let's see what we have. Ha ha. I'll take this one and I'll take this one. And then you just launched them at them in the first 10 minutes.
And how do we make that angel's cocktail? How do we mix those together?
You mean the entire thing?
Yeah. How do we create that angel's cocktail that you talk about in your TEDx talk?
How will it would just be a story which combines all of them. So a story which builds anticipation is dopamine, a story where you are attracted to the character or the object, which is oxytocin, and it ends with a hero kind of grand finale, which is serotonin, and maybe a laugh here and there, which is endorphins. Yeah, and that would be your angel's cocktail. But I would recommend not mixing angel's cocktails. I would recommend taking the story that you indexed, which is high on one or two of these signaling substances, and launch that at them. They don't need complete angel's cocktails. That's just a synonym for if you want to entertain someone. The power lies in picking them.
Right. So understanding the underlying emotions of the stories, what they elicit in the audience, categorizing them so that you have them available when you need them. And then, of course, practicing them, right? And paying attention to the audience as you develop out these stories so that you have one for each of those categories.
Absolutely. Most definitely.
And one of your other famous TEDx talks is the death of the PowerPoint. And when you think about presenting in business, we think about presenting on stage, oftentimes we are using a PowerPoint. And we do change our view of sharing stories and connecting with the audience when there's slides behind us and there's words on the screen. We talked a little bit earlier about this. It is no different whether you're telling stories personally, whether you're telling stories at a networking event, or even you're on stage. We need to be eliciting emotions in the audience. We want their attention. We want their focus. How can we do that when PowerPoint is involved?
Yeah, good point. All right. So I would say that you can still kick ass with dopamine. So a couple of quick tips is the following. Imagine that you bring out a slide and you go, okay, this one. We could probably skip this one. Oh, no. Oh, I know. You can't really read what's on it. But I'll just point here. Yeah, that's a bad way of delivering a slide. Okay, so that is bringing the dopamine down to the floor. Now, a better way, the magical way of delivering a slide is what I call sell your slide. And it goes like this. Just prior to delivering the slide, you go, guys, girls, the next slide coming up is my personal favorite. It summarizes everything in such a beautiful way. So just hold on to your seats. Here we go. Boom. And the dopamine is sky high. People going like, woo. Can't do that every single time. You can't go, next slide is my personal favorite. They'll carry you away if you do that more than like two slides. But you can still sell slides. You can go like, okay, so we've had a look at the theory. Let's have a look at a super exciting example of how this works. And then you bring that out. So dopamine can be used by selling slides. So that's one. There's so many ways to create dopamine in PowerPoint, but I don't know how much you want me to talk about it, but that's one key way.
Well, that's a great example. Are there other emotions in your PowerPoint that you feel are important?
Yeah, absolutely. Second one would be just value everything that you say. You know, like you go like, oh, look at this number. That's a bit worrisome. Ah, I hate this number. Look at this. This excites the heck out of me. Do you see that number? That's 86. It's incredible. When you go like, ooh, I don't know. You know, I'm feeling really, really bothered by this number. This is really getting to me. And it's the end of the month. I don't know. So yeah, value your numbers because every single time you do that, you transfer your emotion to the people listening. So why I'm saying this and why I just wanted to jump into this is because you guys, you're talking about emotion and we're talking about the signaling substance and hormones. Mm-hmm. Why this is absolute core, why this is more important than anything is because if you walk into a meeting room, a conference room, a presentation, and you do not elicit an emotion into those who are listening, you will not move them. You will not make them take a decision. They will nod. They will smile. They will sign. They will walk out of there and something else will attract their emotion and boom, they're off in that direction. If you fail to create that, you fail to move people. And that is why emotion in PowerPoint is so important. And that is why these signaling substances are so important to pick.
Well, we've certainly seen it many times. And a lot of the clients we have can be very overly analytical. And we'll talk about sometimes when they're going into a meeting where they're putting together their PowerPoint presentation. And I will laugh because at the end of the day, they've put most of their efforts into the slides and making sure that the facts are up there.
The numbers all work
out. And I can't count how many folks that we've had in here who do pitches for a living or do marketing are like, throw all that out. Let's make sure that you walk in busting with emotion and to elicit whatever you need, you're going to have to first feel it in yourself. It never ceases to amaze me because, you know, of course, if you're going to school for this, it's going to be all the data points that you think is going to drive this home. But in actuality, you're not in the room if your data points didn't make out. You're in the room because they want you to get them emotionally excited about what you have to offer.
Yeah. Simple as that.
Yeah. With emotions driving decisions, it's important that we at least pay attention to them when we're presenting, when we're sharing stories. Of course, they connect us. And in your TEDx talk on death by PowerPoint, we'll link it up in the show notes. You go into great detail around some slide structure for all of you who are interested in presenting, especially slides. Why do you think people put so much emphasis on the slide deck itself and don't pay attention to the emotion and realize the delivery?
Because we believe that we are rational human beings and that our decisions are rational and logical. And if they are, well, then we can focus on logic. And therefore, we build slides which are truly logical. I think if we truly would have a sense that our decisions are driven by emotion, if we knew that for real and we could feel it all the way into our bone, we would build presentations differently. But people just don't relate to it. It's like I said, 60%, they believe that every single decision they take is rational or driven by rational.
Well, we could see it in a lot of the entertainment that is around us is certainly going to elicit a lot of emotion. But even the information that's presented to us, if we look at all the political strife going on kind of everywhere, but it's all emotionally driven. There may be some data points behind it, but there's going to be a narrative that gets you riled up in order for you to buy into whatever these sides are peddling.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other key point in all of this, and I know you talk about it in your course as well, is first impression. We talk about it in our bootcamp, how important it is to set the tone with a great first impression. Of course, it's going to hook the audience. It's going to get their attention to whatever you're presenting or even sharing stories. What are your thoughts around creating a compelling first impression and its impact in our storytelling?
Yeah, absolutely. Super important. I call it the halo effect and the hell effect, or I call it, well, it is commonly referred to that you can make a first impression in two ways, hell or halo. And interesting studies have shown that if you are interviewing a person for a job and they are 3 minutes late, that will impact your entire perspective of this person during the entire interview. So yeah, the hell and the halo effect is incredibly important. So I put a lot of effort into making the best possible first impression that I can. Not overdoing it, but still making it as good as possible.
And when you're on stage and you have to present, whether it's slides or share a story or give a keynote, what are you focusing on in terms of your first impression to engage the audience?
Well, I run a 7-step psychologically beneficial structure, and I hit every single point of those every single time I present. And I see to that I know my structure and I know my beginning, my first 3 minutes, flawlessly. It's like you could wake me in the middle of the night and I would go like, boom, 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 boom. You could pick any of my keynotes and I could do my 7 steps in a split second. That's what's important to me. And that's when I do keynotes or presentations. If I meet a person, like I'm meeting you or I'm in a one-to-one meeting, my beginning would be different, of course. I would listen a lot more.
Right. And when you're talking about that first 3 minutes, what is the key focus for you?
Building, I listen into which signaling substance they're low in, and then I counteract that with bringing up the signaling substance that I think they or I desire in order for the meeting to have a great outcome.
So there's reading the room, obviously some emotional intelligence there to understand where the signals are high and low for the audience and then working to manage those to your advantage.
Yeah. 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 So a simple one would be say that a person is, one example, I had a meeting about a year ago. I went into the room. There were 3 gentlemen sitting in there. They were all highly ethos individuals. So very strong, very cocky. They didn't really want me there. Mm-hmm. And so what I had to do is I had to break their ethos to begin with, so bring their serotonin down to normal levels. And you can't just go in and give someone a tell-off when you're going into a meeting like that. So you have to do it indirectly. So the way I did it was that I walked into these guys and I said, shook their hands, I greeted them, I gave them a compliment of some sort. And just before I sat down, I said, I was sitting outside and while I was waiting for you, I read through your brochure. And in your brochure, it says that you work with these different types of pedagogy. Now, as you know as well, as well as I know, it's called, the word is andragogy, because obviously you teach adults and you don't teach children. So I just wanted you to know that, because whoever wrote that copy, just have them check that just as a helpful thing. Okay, let's get on with the meeting. Now, obviously, they were the guys who wrote this, but obviously they didn't know that pedagogy is teaching children and andragogy is teaching adults. And I indirectly I lowered their serotonin, their confidence.
So, yeah, so identifying that mistake for them, calling it out indirectly in a way that doesn't attack them, lowers their serotonin, lowers that cockiness, balances out the room.
Yeah. So that could be one way to do it. Yeah.
So understanding, it sounds a lot of, whether we're telling stories or giving presentations or pitching, that the understanding of the audience is the most important step. I feel like a lot of us, when we're trying to memorize our stories or memorize our presentations, we're thinking about all the slides. Oftentimes, we're not paying close attention to the audience. What are some of the key things that you're focusing on when you're paying attention to the audience? Is there body language signals that you're noticing?
So two answers to that. When I build my TED Talks, they are roughly 18 minutes long. It took me 70 hours per TED Talk to build and rehearse. So I do not listen to my audience for a single second when I deliver those. I know and presume their reaction and action to every single thing that I'll be saying, because it's pre-planned. And I don't deliver the TED Talk for the people in the room. Even like in Stockholm, there was 1,000 people listening. I do not deliver it for them. I deliver it for YouTube. And doing that is just different. So yeah, that is one version. If you have 70 hours to prepare an 18-minute presentation in your life, if you don't, it's listening to the audience. And my third TED Talk is called the 110 steps of the 110 techniques, or the 110 steps of excellence, where I spent 7 years studying 5,000 speakers and presenters. And I think I became the first person in the world who detailed every single communication skill human beings use when we communicate. I don't know. I haven't seen anyone else do it. And what's interesting with this is that what I want to come to is this, have you ever walked into a room and you immediately feel that you don't trust the person?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And probably the opposite, where you've met a person and you go like, oh, God, I love you from almost the first instance. You've been there?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. So after studying these 5,000 individuals, I learned to understand that we have 5 layers of communication. And the 5 layers are facial expression, word, voice, body language, and gesture. Now, what's interesting, when you walk into a room where you can't trust a person, there is a discrepancy in their communication. There's something not lining up between these 5. To an example could then be that they say, hey, so good to see you. And you can hear in their voice that, yeah, it's fairly okay. You know, it's good. But their facial expression is not saying the same thing as their voice. And when there's a discrepancy in any one of these 5 layers, you immediately sense it. You don't know what it is. I can, because I've broken it down to 110 different things. But a normal human being wouldn't be able to pinpoint exactly what is wrong in this situation. So when looking at the audience, you should read into the audience in regards to these 5 layers. Have a look at their facial expression. Have a look at their body language. Have a look at their gestures. What's interesting then is that they have to be in synchronicity, i.e. if they got folded arms, and at the same time, they're smiling, that doesn't mean that they're negative. So these have to be, the more they are in synchronicity, the more true you can read a person.
So understanding those 5 layers, and the more congruence there is between the 5, the more accurate that reading of that person is. So if someone has crossed arms and a big smile, and those are the only 2 signals you're seeing, you can't really say that they're either closed off or they're happy.
Absolutely not. No.
And looking at obviously something like a TEDx talk, even in the 70 hours of prep, I'm assuming you were paying close attention in your delivery multiple times to read and sense how the room is going to react. And after practicing it enough times, you can start to make those assumptions that these are the moments that people laugh at. These are the moments that people are really engaged. These are the moments where I know I'm going to get their full attention, et cetera.
Yes, absolutely.
So obviously, understanding, making a great first impression, understanding how these chemicals influence our emotions and working to the best of your abilities to evoke these emotions in your audience. And a lot of practice is how we can become more effective storytellers.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that to simplify it, go with the first thing that I said. Look at all the situations in your life, package it in those four structures where you have the prep, the background, the development, and the conclusion. If that is the only thing that you practice, it'll make you a 500% or 1,000% of a better storyteller within just 6 months. And then you can add the other layers on top of that. But that'll make the biggest difference.
I think the other thing that most people need to realize is, yes, this is a skill that can be developed, but it is within all of us. We have evolved through storytelling. Oh, yeah. We have learned through storytelling. And so for all the times that we hear, well, I'm not a good storyteller, or for all the times that we hear, well, I don't have any good stories to tell, that is just untrue. You just haven't given yourself those opportunities to bring out what is already there inside.
Yeah, absolutely. And to de-dramatize it, just don't call it storytelling, for God's sake. Just retell a daily thing that happened to you in that structure that I just mentioned. And boom, you have a story. It's not, that is simple. And just a really quick one as well, as you haven't asked me about that. How long does something have to be in order to be a story? Okay, so the shortest story ever written was written by Ernest Hemingway. It's 6 words. And it goes like this. It's a sad one. It's oxytocin. Okay. Are you ready for it?
Yeah.
Goes like this. Baby shoes, never worn, for sale. Okay? So that's a story. Because what happens when I tell you that story is that it puts images in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And those images are associated to emotions and references and associations that you have to children who may not have been born. And those emotions are then created through your own fantasy and your own memories. I didn't need to create them in my story. I simply placed the words in your head. So then to argue that stories can be even shorter, what, can they be even shorter than 6 words? Yeah, they can. Because metaphors are the shortest definition of a story.
Right.
Because metaphors, they create images in your head, and to those images, you have associations and memories, and those create emotions. So if I were to say, hey, have you seen the boys' room? Oh, it looks like havoc in there. Or you go, have you seen the boys' room? Looks like an absolute tornado going on in there. Okay, so the second would bring out much more emotion and associations in you. So yeah, stories don't have to, it's not this complicated thing. Just look at it as a story. You create visuals in the head, in the brain of the people listening, and those create, or they are associated to memories, and they create emotions.
Yeah, it's that transfer of emotions, and you don't have to be verbose to do it, as you just described. I think a lot of times exactly that. When we hear storytelling, we tend to overthink it and overanalyze it and try to add all this fluff to it and overcomplicate it. And really being more willing to share and practice and look for opportunities to share those daily moments, especially the ones you've categorized, paying attention to the audience. Are you evoking that emotion, seeing that signaling back? Is a great way to strengthen this skill set.
Mm-hmm.
The last question I have for a lot of us who give keynotes or have to present our ideas, I think we spend a lot of time, as we talked about, on the slides and then prepping for the presentation. But the one piece you can't really control is the audience response and questions after your presentation. What is your mindset? How do you go into your presentations to handle those questions? Because we do know that sometimes the audience can throw some tough questions our way.
Yeah. Okay, so whenever I build a keynote or an entire course for that sake, I always look into what kind of objections can the audience come up with. And then I build in a, I don't know what you call that, a pre-objection.
Well, handling objections.
Yeah. So I then ask myself, how can I handle that objection? I build that into my keynote so that the objection can never happen. It never happens. So when you listen to my keynotes, they are usually at least like 99.5% bulletproof.
Mm-hmm.
If they do come, or if you know that they will be coming, see to it that you induce serotonin and endorphins into your audience, because that will reduce the likeliness of questions like that popping up at the end. The biggest mistake you can do is end your presentation with questions. You should always own your ending. And an ending has three steps. The first step should be questions. So you go, before I summarize, are there any questions? We have 4 minutes for questions. Then you do the summary, and then you do the grand finale. The grand finale is super important because you need to inflict emotion into their brain, go but the trick here is to go, before I summarize, are there any questions? We have 4 minutes. Now you control the entire agenda, because after 4 minutes you can go, okay, time's up. We have to continue now. And then it's perfectly okay. If you haven't said that, it is rude to go in and stop them. But now you have the full authority to do so.
And of course, that gives you an opportunity if for whatever reason you may have fumbled an answer or not felt good about a response to a question, to come back in the summarization and in the grand finale and fix that. So you're not leaving that presentation on a low note where the audience might be doubting your understanding or your viewpoint because of a question you were posed.
Exactly.
So, and are there key steps in the summary? And it sounds like there are important pieces to the grand finale as we get to the grand finale of this interview. What are you looking for to summarize? And what is that last piece in the grand finale?
Well, I love ending whatever keynote presentation I do with a story. So I told you earlier that I have this really, really high injection dopamine stories. So I'd like to end with that, if that's okay with you.
Yeah. Fantastic.
I just love giving content and knowledge to everyone that can listen and who are in need of it. So just look at my 3 TED Talks. That's an awesome summary. Learn from them. But if there's anything in storytelling, it is what I just said previously. And that is just get down there and practice the 4 steps in the storytelling structure in your every single day life. That'll make a tremendous difference. And my 3rd point, because you should only have 3 things in a summary, not 4, not 5, but 3. So this is the 3rd and the last one. And this is the one that will make you most popular of all in any party, at any dinner, with your kids as a parent, as I said. And that is the spontaneous storytelling exercise we did. Give your kid, 6 years old, a place and an object. Let them tell a story. And then boom, another object, boom, another object, boom, another object. You'll be rolling down on the floor. You'll be laughing. You'll be having such a good time. You can do this in a taxi. You can do it on a bus. You can do it wherever you want to. And every single time you do it, you teach them how to do storytelling and you teach yourself to do storytelling. So those 3 things would be core summaries for me. Are you waiting for the grand finale now or?
Yeah, we are.
Where's the silence again?
You got us hanging on the edge of our seat here.
Okay, so the story goes like this. This is the story that changed my perspective on storytelling, and it just did so forever. And it's an old tale. And as with old tales, they began a long, long, long time ago. This is a Jewish tale, and it takes place in the Middle East, in a small, small village. And at the edge of this small, small village, there's a small, little, beautiful house. And in this small, beautiful house lived 2 women. And these 2 women were the most beautiful women you can ever imagine. Now, these 2 women were sisters. And the one sister's name was Story, and the other sister's name was Truth. Now, there was a inherent problem with them thinking that they were beautiful because they were constantly arguing who was the most beautiful. And this particular day, this argument grew into a growl and they started fighting on who was the most beautiful and they couldn't agree. And so they stopped and they say, hey, we cannot agree who is the most beautiful of us 2. Let's have a contest. Let's walk down the middle street of our town and see who attracts most attention. So they went to bed, the morning rose, they walked up to the street and they stood in front of the street. And then Truth said, hey, can I go first, sister? And Story said, yes, of course. So Truth, she stood firmly, she looked down the street and she boosted her self-confidence and she started walking down. As she walked down, you could see the kids playing football, they ran away. You can see the families who are having picnic, they quickly put all their food back in the basket and they walked away. the people behind the blinds. They closed them at the top of the roofs, people, the children, they walked back. So they didn't want to see what they saw. When truth came to the end of the road, she asked herself, why am I not beautiful? Why are people not attracted to me? And she thought, is there any other way I can become even more attractive? And she came up with this brilliant idea. And she unbuttoned her cloak and she let it drop. And there she was, entirely naked. And now with renewed self-confidence, she walked up the street. But instead of people gathering around her, the few that were left, they fled. She came up to her sister and she said, I'm sorry. I don't know what happened, but I didn't attract anyone. And then Story said, don't worry, sister, let me try. Let's see what happens. Story stood there. She stood. She gazed down the street. She built herself with self-confidence. And then she walked down. And this time you could see the kids coming back with their footballs and they were playing on the street. You could see the children and the families. They're sitting down and having their picnics again. And the people behind the blinds, they opened them up. And the kids on the rooftops, they looked down. And Story came to the end of the road. She turned around and she walked back. When she came back, her sister, Truth, said, I'm sorry, sister, I am sorry. You are the most beautiful. You are the one who attracts them all. I have lost. I'm sorry. You are the most beautiful. And then Story said, no, that's not entirely true. It doesn't have to be true. The thing is, though, that people are not attracted by the truth. People are definitely not attracted by the naked truth. What people are attracted to is a story. Well, what people love more than anything is a true story. So Story took her cloak and wrapped it around the shoulders of her sister. And this time, Truth walked down the street with a cloak of Story. And every single person in the entire village and every nearby village flocked around her to watch the most beautiful thing we know, the most attractive thing, which is a true story. Because isn't that true, that every single time you watch a movie and it comes up based on a true story, your entire brain ignites in a way that it doesn't if it's just fictional? That, my friends, is a great story. And the end.
Thank you for sharing and all these amazing storytelling tips. Where can our audience find more about your university and learn how to become such an amazing storyteller like yourself?
Just head to jpuniversity.com and you have a full course on storytelling and every single signal substance and how you inject that in other human beings and the 110 steps, and you can learn it all there.
Right on.
Thank you, guys.
Wow, digging into the science behind storytelling and evoking emotions to have those neurological responses, how to manage the neurotransmitters that are so important to our psychology. It was a fascinating discussion.
It's amazing. And it gave me so many ideas and in different ways to use storytelling that I never thought of before.
I'm excited to play that game with some friends and a few drinks, maybe some glasses of wine. Now, if you're new to the show and you want to know more about what we teach here at The Art of Charm, head on over to theartofcharm.com/toolbox to get our favorite episodes. That's where you'll get the fundamentals of networking, persuasion, and influence, such as body language, eye contact, and more. We've got boot camps running every single month here in Los Angeles, and we'd love for you to join us. They're both for men and women. Details on those at theartofcharm.com.
And don't forget about the Art of Charm Challenge. Go to theartofcharm.com/challenge. The challenge is about improving your networking and connecting skills and inspiring those around you to develop a personal and professional relationship with you. It's free, it's unisex, and it's a great way to get the ball rolling and get some forward momentum. And we'll also send you our fundamentals toolbox that I had mentioned earlier in the show, which includes some great practical stuff ready to apply right away. This will make you a better connector, a better networker, and a better thinker. That's at theartofcharm.com/challenge.
Also, could you do us and the entire Art of Charm team a big favor? Could you go on over to iTunes and rate and review this podcast? It would really mean the world to us and would help others find our show. The Art of Charm podcast is produced by Michael Harold and Eric Montgomery and engineered by Sam Jay and Bradley Denham at Cast Media Studios in sunny downtown Hollywood. Until next week, I'm Johnny.
And I'm AJ. Have a great week.